Good evening, folks, and welcome back. I'm your host, Mark Call. And for crying out loud, how do we try to wrap up a week like this one? The president's in Asia. He met with China's President Xi and also Vladimir Putin more than once. The World War III threat seems to have shifted back to the Middle East. And closer to home, the lies are so thick and so increasingly transparent, they're hard to keep up with. But we'll try, and some of them, regular listeners here, are up to speed on anyway. And would you believe the official narrative for the latest mass church shooting there in Texas is falling apart almost as badly as Las Vegas? What most of that means is that the waste stream really seems to be running scared, and the smoke screens and distractions and outright lies are thicker than ever. Because the alternative might be for the press to have to actually cover treason in the previous regime, from Obama to Hitlery to murders like Seth Rich to cover it up, and the fact that people like Donna Brazile are scared for their very lives and finally starting to tell people, yep, this is what's really been going on, and we've known it for a long time. Heaven forbid that should have to make the front page of the WAPO or New York Times. But it is getting some coverage, at least, and the fact that Donna Brazile is still alive, rather than having joined so many others, including Seth Rich, on the Arkansas dead list, says something dramatic has changed. Not only did she come clean in the book about Hillary having rigged the primary against Bernie Sanders, and the tawdry financial machinations that made that possible, along with corroborating a whole lot of other things that we've been hearing from other sources of late, she put yet another famous conspiracy theory to bed as conspiracy fact. Hillary's health was a really big deal, and the campaign and the DNC and the press all, yes, conspired to cover it up. Appearing in an interview with Tucker Carlson midweek, the former DNC chair suggested that the media were panicked over questions about Hillary's health and lack thereof prior to the election, and she indicated in the book that the concerns about Hillary's health were so real and so severe that it was under serious consideration that she be replaced as a candidate, despite the campaign's best efforts to shroud details of just how bad things were, and she described all of that as shameful. Other stories this week continued to flesh out the depth of criminality and the cover-up of everything up to and including treason. Here's one from The Hill with more details about the Whoremeister himself, James Comey, thankfully now former head of the FBI. And remember how after that infamous tarmac meeting between Loretta Lynch mob and Bill Clinton, he immediately turned tail and said, hey, we're not going to prosecute Hillary for anything. She can get away with murder for crying out loud as much as we care, because, if I'm remembering correctly, he pointed out no prosecutor who basically knew what was going on and wanted to live would dare to prosecute her. Turns out later that the draft of the memo that exonerated her had been around for a long, long time, even before the bogus investigation was downgraded to a mere matter. Now The Hill indicates that there was an even earlier draft of former FBI Director James Comey's statement closing out the Hillary matter, in which he accused the former Secretary of State of having been grossly negligent in handling classified information. This comes from memos newly reported to Congress. That tough language was too tough, because if you understand a little bit about legalism, the term grossly negligent is a legal term that is explicitly referenced in statutes concerning intelligence and national security. It's a felony, and results in something that can be punished at a minimum with fines and jail time. Oops. And, of course, we simply can't have that. So the tough language was changed to the much softer, kinder, and gentler accusation that Clinton had been extremely careless in her handling of classified information when Comey announced in July of 2016 there would be no charges filed against her because, you know, she's above the law. Now, remember, if a midshipman or other low-level grunt in any of the armed forces was extremely careless with classified information, they have, and indeed probably still would, suffer actual consequences for the crime, from court-martial and dishonorable discharge to Fort Leavenworth. But if you're grossly negligent, well, that's a whole different deal, and it's certainly not something that Comey was ever going to be allowed to accuse the woman who would be king of doing. On the scummy scale, we saw a lot more hypocrisy this week that just demonstrates one more time how far gone the waste stream media's really gotten. And it kind of lends new meaning to the word hypocrisy in coverage, too. This hit piece showed up Thursday night into Friday in the WAPO. accusing Alabama justice and now leading candidate for the Senate from the state of sexual indiscretion well over 3 decades ago. And if nothing else, it graphically demonstrates just how desperate the deep state is to prevent yet another person from showing up on the Senate floor that's actually read the Constitution. Chris Manahan puts it this way. The WAPO dropped a diabolical hit piece Thursday on Roy Moore, featuring 4 women accusing him of making sexual advances on them when they were teens and he was in his early 30s. 3 of the women claim Moore kissed them as older teenagers between 30 and 40 years ago. 1 woman claims that 38 years ago, when she was 14 and he was 32, he took her on dates and eventually kissed her and touched her through her underwear. Which means, of course, he'd have been laughed out of Hollywood for something like that and denied even an associate producer's job. And don't even think about running for president, Roy, if that's all you can get away with. For his part, Justice Moore's campaign released a statement saying the following, quote, Judge Roy Moore has endured the most outlandish attacks on any candidate in the modern political arena, but this story in today's Washington Post alleging sexual impropriety takes the cake. National liberal organizations know their chosen candidate Doug Jones is in a death spiral. Latest polls, the release notes later, show the judge with a double-digit lead. And this is their last ditch, Hail Mary. It's not like the Washington Post, too, hasn't already endorsed the judge's opponent, they note. And they've been engaged in a systematic campaign for months to distort the truth about the judge's record and career and derail his campaign. But there's apparently no end, they say, to what the Post is willing to allege. Further down in the WAPO story, this little tidbit from one of the accusers emerges. I'll quote it. Debbie Wesson Gibson says that she was 17 in the spring of 1981 when Moore spoke to her Etowah High School civics class about serving as the assistant district attorney. He says that when he asked her out, she asked her mother what she would say if she wanted to date a 34-year-old man. Gibson says her mother asked her who the man was, and when Gibson said Roy Moore, her mother replied, I'd say you were the luckiest girl in the world. Because he was a hometown boy made good, says Gibson, noting he was a West Point grad and so forth. Gibson goes on to say they dated for several months, during which time he took her to his house, read her poetry, and played his guitar. She says he kissed her once in his bedroom and once by the pool at a local country club. But nothing beyond that actually happened. Says pundit Vox Day about this bombshell revelation. Perhaps a bit tongue-in-cheek. Well, if dating a girl who is of the age of consent and not taking advantage of her over a period of several months of dating doesn't disqualify a man for the Senate, I don't know what does. We continue with more media weirdness, bait and switch, and outright in-your-face hypocrisy. This next one comes via InfoWars, which rightfully asks a serious question, looking at a headline from Newsweek. Why, says Newsweek, is the alt-right obsessed with pedophilia? I mean, who cares about a few kids in Washington or Hollywood getting raped, sold into sex slavery, and maybe even sacrificed on altars to Satan? Besides which, 40 years ago, Judge Roy Moore was dating teenage girls. What are you nutcase alt-right folks worried about? Newsweek published that article with their disgusting headline, notes InfoWars and Alex Jones, in an attempt to delegitimize any grievances towards pedophiles and sexual predators that seem to be literally coming out of the woodwork, now that the truth is being admitted, first in Hollywood, and eventually, one can hope, out of Washington. But maybe we repeat ourselves, because for the most part, those are the same folks, just flying back and forth over flyover country and doing their dirty deeds. For example, not only did Bill and Hill ride convicted sexual predator and, oh yeah, Wall Street mogul Jeffrey Epstein's Lolita Express down to his sex island on more than one occasion, there are even late reports that the now-disgraced actor Kevin Spacey took that ride along with Bill at least once. Which brings me to the kind of story that your host doesn't usually do. We'll get rid of it briefly, but it does seem appropriate at least this once. Inside Hollywood, and it's meta news that at least indicates, hey, maybe people there are starting to wake up, kind of like the NFL may eventually, to the fact that this is costing them real money to have it exposed just how seedy, scummy, and ultimately disgustingly pedophilic and even satanic they really are. Here's the headline from the Daily Mail. Kevin Spacey, didn't we just talk about him, has now been airbrushed from a new movie. The disgraced actor's scenes have been sensationally axed, says the story, from Ridley Scott's new $40 million blockbuster. The movie's called All the Money in the World, just 6 weeks before its scheduled release, as the cast and crew agreed to immediately reshoot all of the disgraced actor's scenes with Christopher Plummer, instead playing the role of the late oil tycoon J. Paul Getty. Director Scott made the decision unilaterally, it is reported, and only notified Sony Pictures of his decision on late Wednesday afternoon. And in case you've missed the story, the 58-year-old actor, who was also axed from his TV role, has been written out of the film in a bold move by the director in the wake of multiple sexual assault allegations, including homosexual pedophilia. And this comes after the movie was pulled from its prestigious closing night slot at the AFI Film Festival this month and had its awards campaign halted. So at least the director Ridley Scott here is taking the exposure of Kevin Spacey and the box office disaster that he might be seriously. And I think you'd have to argue that's kind of sort of good news. From the Daily Bell next, a follow-up on the assault and battery of the Senate's most libertarian and constitutionally literate member, Dr. Rand Paul. Their headline concerns media blame, call it bias of a different sort, and their suggestion that Rand Paul literally deserved to be attacked. This piece is by Joe Jarvis, who says, "The media has gotten their narrative, and they're sticking to it. It doesn't matter," he observed, "that a shooter specifically targeted a Republican softball practice back in June. That didn't fit their narrative then that it's the right brewing hatred and violence." So, most media was quiet about the Democrat Bernie supporter and shooter. Later, your host interjects, we note that they seem to have taken a softened attitude when it comes to violence, if at least it's perpetrated against conservatives, by good guys like anti-fascists. So, it would seem that beating people over the head with pipes and chains is okay if it's conservatives that are getting whacked. You may recall that there were even, yes, and I'm not kidding, some leftist nutcase progressives who wrote after Las Vegas that since this was a country music festival populated mostly by white folk and almost certainly Trump voters and MAGA supporters, they probably deserved what they got anyway. Senator Rand Paul was one of the members of Congress at that softball practice back in June who escaped with his life because there were armed people present. And now, for the second time this year, he has literally been attacked by another Antifa-type progressive leftist. The story notes he was a Democrat, but Democrat doesn't seem to fit anymore, does it? Rand Paul was attacked in his home earlier this week by his neighbor. First, news outlets made it seem that this was just a silly little case of neighbors feuding over something associated with landscaping or the length of the lawn. But then it came out that Dr. Paul suffered 5 fractured ribs, a punctured lung, and some literally life-threatening injuries as he was violently tackled from behind while he was mowing his lawn wearing hearing protection. And yeah, you heard that right. A senator actually mowing his own lawn. Who'd have thought it? He was blindsided and didn't realize what hit him until it was too late. And as if the nonchalant attitude of the media wasn't enough, GQ has now published a piece entitled, "Rand Paul Sounds Like the Worst Guy to Have as a Neighbor." And no, folks, we're not kidding. "That's it," says Jarvis. "Blame the victim. Rand Paul deserved to be attacked because he's conservative, believes the Constitution deserves to be read, and he's probably an annoying neighbor to boot." Here he quotes this disgusting piece from GQ. I'll have to do a little bit of editing. Quote, "So let's read between the lines a bit here," they wrote. "Rand Paul is an a**hole neighbor. He bought a house in a neighborhood that has certain rules about lawns, and he decided he doesn't need to follow those rules because of his belief in property rights that they say don't actually exist anyway. This, at its core, is the problem with libertarianism. Libertarians don't want to follow the rules that we as a society have agreed upon because they feel those rules step on their freedoms. And sometimes they might even be right, but that doesn't mean that they're above those rules and can do whatever they want." Says author Joe Jarvis, GQ never bothered to find out whether Rand Paul actually broke any of the rules, nor even specifically what they were. But they did note that he composts and grows pumpkins on his property. How dare he? Sounds like a pretty big scumbag, says Jarvis. Well, now to be fair, I don't know why Paul would buy a home in a strict neighborhood, and he did evidently voluntarily join the neighborhood association, meaning there is an agreement in place, and you ought to abide by the pre-existing rules. And here your host can't help interjecting, you know, I'm not even sure that represents the whole story. But the hypocrisy that we're getting around to really is the point here. A true libertarian, writes Jarvis, might have decided instead to buy a bunker off the grid somewhere in the remote hills of Kentucky. But, he says, I do think it's funny, the major complaints against Paul involve composting. And you'd think that, at least, would be enough to endear him to some of the left, because he's putting otherwise wasted food scraps to good use instead of filling up the landfills. But instead, they complain he's just a jerk because a neighborhood association evidently says composting is verboten. And it's also pretty damned ironic, says the author, that the article dares to complain about Rand Paul breaking his neighborhood association rules, because at the same time they're glossing over the fact that the neighbor actually committed a felony and hit him from behind and broke his ribs. You know, that little other rule that they want to ignore nowadays about how you're not supposed to violently attack people. But don't worry, says Jarvis, GQ did at least put part of the blame on the violent attacker. I guess this is how they excuse Antifa. Maybe that's part of the point of doing this story. Now, they wrote, we don't want to excuse the other side of this. One of the problems with Democrats is we've never met government oversight that we don't like. And there's a good metaphor for Democratic politics and the obnoxious homeowners association rules that drive everyone crazy. So it sure seems like this Rene Boucher was also an ass who cared way too much about what his neighbor's yard looked like. Unquote, and so, continues the real author here, Joe Jarvis, it just seems like a guy who broke five of his neighbor's ribs over grass clippings was also possibly an asshole. Actually, it seems like he was more a typical worshiper of the almighty state, one who sounds like he thinks violence and threats can solve all problems. And therein, folks, lies the rub. We really are at a point where the media has gone absolutely off the cliff when it comes to nutcased leftist sensibilities and ignoring little trivialities like, hey, breaking someone's ribs not only isn't tolerant and worshipful of diversity, it's downright unneighborly. And if you're suspecting by now that trend changes like this one, subtle as they may be, indicate that somebody at least is pushing for Civil War 2.0, we're on the same page. Related story, how many times have we seen stuff like this of late? The headline pretty well gets it. Comes from Max Slavo via SHTF Plan and Zero Hedge and now other places. Hate crime hoax, it says. A black Air Force cadet has admitted to writing racial slurs targeting blacks while attempting to generate hate crime outrage. And in case you didn't hear about this story all the way back in September, the Waste Stream, of course, had a heyday with it. The offender wrote nasty things like, go home, and then the N-word, on the door to his own dorm room at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Massive outrage followed, and an Air Force investigation, whereupon Tuesday, the Air Force Academy had to announce that the black cadet who was supposedly the victim of the racial slurs was, in fact, the one that was writing them. Quote, we can confirm that one of the cadet candidates who was allegedly targeted by racist remarks written outside of their dorm room was actually responsible for the act, said the Academy in a statement. Why, already he's learned how false flags work. Maybe he's angling for a job at the Federal Bureaus of Instigation. Or who knows, maybe straight to one of George Soros' fine social justice warrior organizations once he gets out. So here we are. Newsweek excuses pedophilia, wonders how anybody could possibly be upset about something like that. At least some Hollywood directors are starting to figure out when it comes to the bottom line, they better be careful there. Libertarians, conservatives, Bible believers, and MAGA supporters cannot be allowed free speech, but if anybody else wants to shut them down, violence is perfectly okay in that case. Same thing goes for equality and diversity. Racism is a mortal sin, unless we're talking about white people, in which case, well, they deserve it. And, of course, if we're talking about racial justice, lying and false flags are just fine, because the ends justify the means. At least, that's the meme that we're being fed now by much of the Waste Stream press. And you know what, folks? That's just today's news. Remember, all of this builds on the lawlessness that we've seen developing for quite some time, where a midshipman who makes the mistake of taking a picture of himself to send to a girlfriend, but in the background happens to be a panel that might be considered confidential on, say, a submarine, gets court-martialed. But if you have tens of thousands of emails that literally compromise national security, might get an ambassador killed, and you sell uranium to our enemies to boot, that's perfectly okay, as long as you're getting the right bribes and are running for president, and of course have high-ranking whores at the top of the FBI covering for you. Better still, if they can blame the person who beat you in an election you thought you had rigged by blaming your adversary and the dreaded Ruskies for what you did. When you step back and look at it, is it any wonder that we're seeing that you, in fact, really do reap what you sow, both on an individual level and even more clearly when it comes to a society? A couple of stories from the world of science, whether we hear it this way or not, right up front. NASA is now admitting that, you know what, it just may be the reason there's so much Antarctic ice melting. No, it's not man-made global warming. It's not because Donald Trump got us out of the bogus Paris agreements. It's because there just might be a huge supervolcano underneath the West Antarctic ice cap that's causing a lot of melting. The story from Newsweek says almost as hot as Yellowstone. A major mantle plume producing, yes, as much heat as Yellowstone's supervolcano appears to be melting part of West Antarctica from below. Researchers at NASA have now admitted, well, it says discovered here, a huge upswelling of hot rock under Marie Byrd Land, which lies between the Ross Ice Shelf and the Ross Sea, and it's creating vast lakes and rivers under the ice sheet. The presence of the huge mantle plume could explain why the region is so unstable today and why it collapsed so quickly at the end of the last ice age 11,000 years ago that, no, wasn't ended by your SUV then either. Your host will again note that we've seen an upsurge in volcanism over the last few years, especially around what's called the Ring of Fire. And all of this, other researchers that aren't getting paid for man-made global warming, bogus science, have been saying seems to be associated with a periodic decline in solar output. As to how that connection plays out, I guess we'll see. Because we seem to be headed down in that direction when it comes to colder winters to come. Last time around, the approximately 205-year cycle ended in something known as the Maunder Minimum. This was a big week in many respects on the World War III front, and of course, as you know, if you really want to understand how that's coming down, follow the money, and in particular, the yuan for oil trade as a key indicator. Early in the week, there were missiles fired from Yemen towards Saudi Arabia in that old war that's seeking to escalate. Turns out as the week progressed, they seem to have come from Iran. Surprise, surprise. The big news from the region early in the week, though, seems to have been what's now referred to as the Saudi Purge. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had 11 princes and 38 current and former senior officials arrested on charges of corruption and money laundering. Most notably, Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, the highest profile member of the bunch, who's a major shareholder in both Citi and Twitter, a Trump basher, and a financial supporter of Hillary's campaign. Same thing goes for others arrested, and they were longtime supporters of the almighty petrodollar. Word slipped out midweek that MBS, as he's known, or Mohammed bin Salman, is almost certainly going to be king real soon now, perhaps before the weekend is out, as the aging and allegedly senile Saudi monarch is turning over the reins of power. Financial analyst and partner of Jim Sinclair at JSMindset.com, Bill Holter, had some interesting comments on all of these developments. He wasn't alone in that regard, given, he said, that those arrested could be seen as players with deep state connections aligned with Hitler's crew, and given as well that MBS has recently met with both Mr. Putin of Russia and Mr. Xi of China, and Saudi Arabia has announced purchases of S-400 weapons from Russia. There are certainly major implications here for what was once the major U.S. partner propping up the petrodollar. Says Bill Holter, in my opinion, the Saudis are now triggering a move to accept Chinese yuan for oil. No doubt some of this move has been a long time in the works. And don't forget, he suggests, that the Chinese and Russians already know exactly how crooked and fraudulent the U.S. has been in business dealings during past years. Those that have dealt with the Clinton Foundation know that firsthand. And he goes on to say that he believes Mr. Trump may very well find out that a deal has already been done and nothing he can do will stop it. Meaning that the next couple of weeks could be breathtaking. And given how long-standing China's interest has been in things like acquiring gold, setting up the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and moving towards the ability to trade for oil in terms of yuan or some alternative, at any rate, to the almighty dollar, those with eyes to see may just be able to spot a whole flock of black swans on the horizon. We'll be back right after this.
Just like yesterday, then I'll get on.
are back now, second segment of this evening's show. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's kick this one off with one of the other stories from this week that at least the Waste Stream was really anxious to hype, although their spin tends to overlook certain facts. We'll start with the obvious, yet another leftist atheist, in this case, nutcase, going out and doing precisely what the deep state so badly, obviously, wants them to do. Kill as many people as possible, and in the process strengthen the idiotic narrative for destroying what's left of the Bill of Rights. And let me kick that off this way. The headlines on Sunday into Monday, and for that matter still, were parroting a narrative we've gotten sick of hearing, rather than what they should have been saying, like, for example, latest mass shooting points out again the massive failure that is gun control and why, one more time, we've seen a graphic demonstration of why infringement of the right to keep and bear arms is still prohibited by the supreme law of the land. And the tens of thousands of so-called laws that infringe that God-given right inevitably results in more lawlessness and more death. Firearms have been around, and indeed widespread, since before the founding of the Republic. And that goes for so-called assault rifles and even full-auto rifles before the scourge of lawlessness that was prohibition and brought us the mafia. Guns, in other words, have been far more widespread in these formerly United States in the past than they are now. So what's the difference? As if that wasn't already obvious. And furthermore, why is the press not talking about the caustic atheism of this latest gun control poster boy, or for that matter, what SSRI drugs he's probably taking? The cover-up artists may not be very good at controlling the narrative, but at least they're good and good at one thing. It sure didn't take very long for the deep state and its minions in the fraudulent bunglers of investigations to purge the alleged lone gunman's social media footprint, did it? You already know what I'm talking about, I'm virtually certain. Yet another mass shooting, and at another church this time as well. And if you're starting to see a pattern here that the Waste Stream would really prefer you ignore, the good news is you're not alone on that score. The knee-jerk and truly pagan totalitarians are already doing what we've seen them do so many times it's now beyond sickening. They're turning to superstition and blaming inanimate objects rather than looking at readily observable facts, which haven't changed. Not to mention history, economics, and of course human nature, which haven't changed either. So yes, we're talking about yet another mass murder, this time in a rural community called Sutherland Springs, Texas, about 30 miles from San Antonio, where a dishonorably discharged, clearly Antifa-sympathizing atheist violated all kinds of laws, which clearly didn't matter anyway because, you know, he's a murderer. And bad guys, by definition, tend to violate laws, especially really stupid ones that are in violation of the supreme law themselves, and tend to make things easier for the bad guys by disarming the good guys. Thankfully, in this case, not all the good guys were disarmed, even though churches are often called soft targets, along with places like shopping malls and schools where large quantities of victims tend to be disarmed and congregated together. Isn't that appealing to murderers, wouldn't you think? Trouble is, so far as the narrative is concerned, this one wasn't as soft as, say, a target in Los Angeles, Chicago, or New York. In other words, this candidate for the Darwin Awards didn't pick a completely gun-free killing zone, because there did turn out to be good people who were armed, which finally put an end to the carnage and demonstrated yet again, for those with eyes to see, why it's so important that good people not continue to fall into the trap here and allow themselves to be disarmed, like the totalitarian followers of Mao, Stalin, and yes, Adolf, are so intent on forcing them to. I really do think that these false flag terror events are having an unintended consequence, at least among that portion of the population who understand what's going on here, that are increasingly starting to carry guns for exactly this kind of eventuality in exactly these kind of places. And that's good news. There have been a number of church shootings now stopped by armed parishioners. In this case, as you've probably heard by now too, the wannabe mass murderer and poster boy for the terror state was confronted by local hero Stephen Wilford, age 55, who shot him through his body armor as the gunman tried to leave the church. Evidently, he had a rifle by this point, and then along with another good guy, gave chase until eventually the alleged lone gunman either succumbed to that injury, killed himself in a car crash, or followed his programming and did himself in. It's not clear which. And so far, those details still haven't been forthcoming. But we're used to that, too. And at least in this case, there's an interesting possibility here, and that is that police might even be protecting the two heroes from liability, given a legal system that seems to be far more interested in punishing heroes than prosecuting felons and mass murderers, not to mention swamp critters. So let's pause here and take a look back through the smoke. As of Sunday morning, I was seeing some headlines from the alternative side of the web basically saying, hey, what if Soros tried to throw an Antifa revolution and nobody bothered to show up? Except, of course, in Los Angeles, where the politically correct fruits and nuts obviously care a lot more about communism and shutting down free speech than they do about trivial things, like rampant sexual abuse and pedophiles running Hollywood. No protests on that front. At least the hypocrisy is consistent. Because the claim is that in Los Angeles, about 2,000 showed up to celebrate totalitarian tolerance, while hardly anyone did anywhere else. So while some folks were celebrating the good news that most Americans weren't buying into that particular set of lies, not to worry, the deep state already had other plans. Maybe that attempt to kick off Civil War 2.0 strongly was nothing but a head fake all along. And the real threat was always supposed to be the ISIS-Antifa army of alleged lone gunmen, like we've seen trotted out so many times of late, from Sandy Hook to Orlando to Las Vegas to that church in southern Texas. And you know what, folks? If any of that is true, you can set your watch by the fact that more and more of this army of lone gunmen are going to be trotted out in the days and weeks to come. And as the old lies and excuses for gun confiscation keep falling apart, they need to be replaced with new ones. And no reasons to be afraid, be very afraid anyway. Speaking of which, come to think of it, remember the shooting in Las Vegas? Yeah, it's kind of disappeared from the news cycle, hasn't it? I guess that's increasingly likely when the narrative begins to fall apart and there's no more political hay to be made anyway, especially when stories like these keep coming out and needing to be ignored. A new audio recording says true news of the emergency first responders' communications released Tuesday has now completely destroyed whatever was left of the official narrative that Stephen Patsy Paddock acted alone, yes, the dreaded lone wolf gunman, in the massacre at the Harvest Music Festival last month. The audio released by a Las Vegas reporter comes from recordings of firefighters who were responding to the mass casualty event, and about midway through the three-hour recording, the dispatcher states that the wife of a firefighter is pinned down with a second shooter. A what? Yes, a second shooter in the Foundation Bar, located on the top floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel. The web-based version of the story includes the audio recording and a written transcript, as well as the author and entrepreneur Grant Cardone's recollection that Mandalay Bay was advising guests that there, in fact, were multiple active shooters moving throughout the hotel and casino, and that doesn't count all the other reports of shooters in other places, from the floor of the venue to other neighboring hotels, like the lobby of the Bellagio and so forth. Additionally, air traffic control recordings, which your host has heard, they certainly sounded authentic, but remember, even videos nowadays are reasonably easy to fake, especially if you're a three-letter agency. Although, at least up front, agencies like FBI tend to make videos go away. If they reappear at all, you can bet it'll be much later. Anyway, those air traffic control recordings from the airport's control tower from that night state that there were additional shooters, in fact, on the runways at McCarran International Airport, adjacent to the music festival venue. And true to form, before this week was even out, the latest mass shooter narrative at the Texas church was also beginning to fall apart via multiple reports of, say it with me folks, multiple shooters. In a brief interview, that seems to be the key word, from the hospital via ABC News, a woman said that there was a shooter on the roof. Quote, "I didn't just hear them, I saw them, and then people went down." She noted that the shooter reloaded his shotgun twice before a third volley was fired at churchgoers from inside the room. "He was on top. That's how I got shot back there," said the woman, while pointing towards her shoulder blade. Meanwhile, other witnesses are asking why the FBI, which doesn't have jurisdiction anyway because they claim it's not a terrorist event, is still federally blocking the investigation, throwing roadblocks in the way of bereaved family members to even identify their dead loved ones or bury them as they might want. Yeah, they're specifying closed caskets and restricting viewing of the bodies, which almost makes the cynical among us think they're trying to hide something, like different kinds of bullet wounds from multiple kinds of weapons. But really, have they ever lied before? From here, let's return to the central point, at least what your host would suggest is the central point that's being covered up, and that has to do with the old saying, follow the money, or since we haven't had any real money for a long time, follow the currency, the fiat currency. I'll start with some observations from a fellow that your host has had the privilege to have known, at least professionally, for quite a few years now, Dr. Ron Paul. He recently did an interview with Adam Taggart at peakprosperity.com, in part concerning his new book, The Revolution at 10 Years, during which Dr. Paul looks ahead at the future of the movement, dedicated to things like freedom, honest money, rejection of a police state and military empire, and liberty under the Constitution and Bill of Rights that he helped launch, later termed the Tea Party, before it began to depart from those same principles. Says Taggart in his introduction, as a multi-term member of Congress, Dr. Paul knows the players and policies responsible for the growing unfairness and inequality now rampant in society, and he doesn't expect the offenders to reform willingly. Instead, he predicts the system will collapse under its own unsustainability, offering a rare and valuable chance then for a more sound and fair solutions to prevail. Dr. Paul puts it this way, quote, "Wealth doesn't come from the creation of money, especially a fiat system. With too much fiat money and all this credit, eventually the economy becomes exhausted and engulfed with debt and malinvestments. The treatment for this is a correction. You have to allow the debt to be liquidated. You have to get rid of the malinvestment that you have and allow real economic growth to start all over again. But that wasn't permitted back in 08 and 09, which is why there's been such stagnation. It's hard to believe that today, he says, we have negative interest rates. Real rates are negative, and people still aren't grabbing them up. A shortage of money isn't the problem here. Rather, it's a shortage of understanding market conditions. We're overtaxed and overregulated, he contends, which is, of course, pretty hard to disagree with. This, he says, is resulting in a destructive system that's divided the country into two groups, those who haven't recovered from the great financial crisis versus those who are getting very rich because they're on the receiving end of the new money created by the Federal Reserve. The people that get to create the credit get to distribute the credit, which always results in a situation where money becomes unfairly distributed and its allocation is no longer dependent on productivity. Basically, says Dr. Paul, we haven't changed anything. We still have a system where we encourage people to borrow money, that debt doesn't matter, and we're not going to really cut taxes. We're not even going to admit that we spend too much money. Nobody can cut anything, he says. That's why Washington is at such a stalemate. A lot of people don't like Obamacare, but there's enough people who do like it. And once it's been implemented, it's very hard to get rid of a program. Dr. Paul also doesn't think the proposed tax reforms will actually lower taxes. Quote, they never do, he says. Our politicians won't admit where the real problem lies. Overspending, monetizing debt, taking over the whole world through the monetary system, financing wars, financing welfare, and the military-industrial complex. It's going to continue until this whole thing comes apart. Ultimately, he says, the eventual event will be driven by the marketplace, and when it becomes undone, they'll no longer be able to prop things up by just printing more money. If we have a sharp downturn and they decide, well, QE didn't work because it wasn't enough, and they double QE, there'll be a point, says Dr. Paul, of no return, and then all confidence will be lost. And here your host interjects that Austrian economists have typically called this the crack-up boom, when the general public realizes that the dollar they have in their wallet will never, ever be worth as much in the future as it is at this very instant. So you better dump it while you can, kind of like the old maid card game. We'll dump the dollar, he says. Interest rates will go up instead of down. That'll make all the difference in the world because it will be unsustainable and create real challenges for the dollar remaining the reserve currency. And when the dollar no longer serves as the world's key currency, that's when the ball game will be over, unquote. Michael Snyder of the Economic Collapse blog emphasizes the points that were just made by noting that closings of retail stores have hit a new record high while West Coast homelessness soars. If the U.S. economy, he asks up front, is doing just fine, then why have we already shattered the all-time record for retail store closings in a single year? Yes, people like to blame the dominance of Amazon. And while one can't deny that online shopping is on the rise, it still accounts for less than 10% of total U.S. retail sales. No, he suggests something bigger is happening in our economy, and it isn't receiving nearly enough attention, maybe it's the smokescreen, from the waste stream. Back in 2008, he said, a plummeting economy absolutely devastated retailers, resulting in an all-time high, a record of 6,163 retail stores being closed that year. But so far, in 2017, we're already over 6,700 stores that have been shut down with nearly 2 months to go. Already about 10% above that previous record. But wait, there's more. In the liberal bastion of the city of Seattle, there are about 400 unauthorized tent camps of homeless people in parks, under bridges, on freeway medians, and along busy sidewalks. So much, he says, for the Seattle economy doing so well. But in downtown San Diego, they're actually scrubbing the sidewalks with bleach because the growing homeless population is spreading hepatitis A everywhere. And over the past 2 years, he notes, at least 10 cities or municipal regions in California, Oregon, and Washington have all declared states of emergency because homelessness has gotten so far out of control. Does that sound like a healthy economy to you? What if there was an economic collapse, the middle class was devastated, and the waste stream simply refused to cover it? After all, we've got terrorists to import, a lot more churches, shopping malls, and schools probably need to be shot up, or bicyclists and pedestrians to be run over, and there are a whole lot of guns still to be confiscated. No doubt the media will shift the focus later on to taking first big trucks, and then owner-driven cars after that. I mean, really, if the peons can't be trusted to speak freely or defend themselves against tyranny in government, why, for crying out loud, should they be allowed to go wherever they want, whenever they want? Once the meltdown gets underway, they won't be able to afford it anyway. But if Big Brother and his public-private partners are successful in dumbing people down to the point where they don't understand why or what's going on, maybe it really won't matter. Facebook founder says a headline from Zero Hedge warns that, quote, God only knows what his creation, Facebook, is doing to kids' brains. 38-year-old founding president of Facebook, Sean Parker, was recently interviewed by Axios, and he was uncharacteristically frank about his creation, so much so, in fact, that he concluded Mark Zuckerberg will probably block his account after reading what he said. As Zero Hedge put it, he confirmed literally every Big Brother conspiracy there is about the social media giant and explained how social networks purposefully hook users and potentially, he noted, hurt our brains. Quote, when Facebook was getting going, I had these people who would come up to me and they would say, I'm not on social media. And I would say, okay, you know, you will be. Sounds a little bit like Yoda, doesn't it? You will be. And then they would say, no, 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 I value my real-life interactions. I value the moment. I value presence. I value intimacy. And I would say, well, we'll get you eventually. I don't know, he continued, if I really understood the consequences of what I was saying. Because the unintended consequences of a network, when it grows to 1 billion or 2 billion people, it literally changes your relationship with society, with each other. It probably interferes with productivity in weird ways. God only knows, he said, what it's doing to our children's brains. And then he went on to say the thought process that went into building these applications, Facebook being the first of them, was all about how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible. This, he said, was accomplished by, quote, we'll give you a little dopamine hit every once in a while, unquote. And by that, he meant a like or somebody commenting on something you posted, summarizing it this way. It's a social validation feedback loop, exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. And he added that he and Zuckerberg and all the other creators, quote, understood this consciously. That's not all, folks. There was this unsettling comment in there as well. He pointed out that now as a billionaire, he expects that he now will have good enough medical care to live for a long, long time, maybe another 100 years or so, and added, quote, give us billionaires an extra 100 years and you'll know what wealth disparity looks like, unquote. Let's start to wrap up this evening where we began, with the deep state war against the rule of law and how all of that seems to be coming to a head, with DNC head Donna Brazile's confirmation of things we've really known for a long time, perhaps representing the snowball that kicks off the avalanche. And you do have to ask the obvious question. Is the fact that she's still alive an indication that the deep state may have decided to throw Bill and Hill under the bus? Have they finally become more of a liability than an asset? For now, the really thick smokescreen seems to be keeping what's really happening under wraps. But I can't help but think, long term, if Donna Brazile survives, it means Hitlery and company won't. Likewise, more information just keeps oozing out about what a swamp creature the evil Robert Mueller is. Here's a piece from Alex Thomas via the Daily Sheeple about how Robert Mueller's FBI purposefully kept Congress in the dark about Russia's massive and illegal involvement with American uranium companies. That we knew, even if most of those who follow the waste stream didn't. Over the weekend it came out, even if for the most part the waste stream would prefer to ignore it, that Florida Republican Representative Matt Gaetz introduced a resolution that called for former FBI Director, the much compromised, to put it mildly, Robert Mueller, to step down as special counsel for the so-called Russia investigation, arguably because he knows more about it than anybody that would come forward as a witness anyway. He was directly involved with covering up Russia's, quote, significant and illegal involvement with American uranium companies. And yes, as if we didn't know this, the man who is supposedly on the job to find out whether or not the Trump campaign colluded with Russia was actually head of the FBI when they covered up all of the corrupting influences that the Ruskies had with the woman who was supposed to be king, and also purposefully stopped a key witness from contacting Congress about all of that corruption. In other words, says Thomas, Mueller is a deep state operative who is literally guilty of what he claims to be investigating the president for and ought to resign because there's no chance whatsoever that this investigation will be unbiased, much less lawfully conducted. Said Gaetz in the statement accompanying the introduction of his resolution, new evidence, very same evidence that outlets like MSNBC have implied was criminal to even talk about, has emerged, proving that the Mueller-run FBI withheld key information from Congress in what amounts to a massive cover-up. Quote, although federal agents possessed this information in 2010, the Department of Justice, SIC, continued investigating this so-called matter for over 4 years. The FBI, led at that time by Robert Mueller, required the confidential witness to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Unquote, declared Gaetz. And when that witness attempted to contact Congress and federal courts about the bribery and corruption he saw, he was threatened with legal action. So by silencing him, said the congressman, Obama's Just Us Department and Mueller's FBI knowingly kept Congress in the dark about Russia's significant and illegal involvement with American uranium companies, and now they have the chutzpah, your host interjects here, to try to blame Russia without any evidence at all for something entirely different. Said Gaetz, these deeply troubling events took place when Mr. Mueller was director of the FBI. As such, his impartiality, sick, is hopelessly compromised. He must step down immediately. Unquote. Meanwhile, though, your host did hear something interesting via Liz Conklin when she appeared on the Hagman & Hagman report late last week. While I don't necessarily believe what she was suggesting, it sure would be nice if it was true. Conklin suggests that while Mueller was certainly a tool of the Obama regime and covered for Hitler and, of course, Bill before that, maybe he didn't like it, that he really was a good man all along who was bristling at having to do their evil, dirty work and cover all that stuff up. So maybe, she suggests, he's using this as an opportunity to play the ultimate game of chess and work with Trump rather than against him, under the cover of the bogus Rusky investigation, to get to the heart of the real one. And maybe without all the key witnesses being Arkansided in the process. To eventually bring all of these swamp critters to justice. Oh, but that it were true. She even seemed to suggest that arrests, massive, surprising, high-level arrests, could be happening real soon now. Trump's out of the country. Things are coming to a head now on so many fronts. Unfortunately, I just can't quite bring myself to believe it, even if it would be really nice. But wait, folks, before the week was out, there were literally tons of confirmed reports of dozens of sealed indictments in the D.C. area alone, and hundreds nationwide. Is it good news, bad news, or just a battle coming to a head? One thing, though, is really hard to argue with. The continuing string of false flag, alleged lone gunman, mass murders are certainly serving not only as a smokescreen and a distraction, but so far at least has kept the real high crimes and misdemeanors out of the headlines. And don't forget the fear factor. You do have to admit it's been working so far for quite a while now, with the likes of Donna Brazile and Seth Rich and the list of others before him, Pizza Man John Podesta, Huma Abedin and her former husband, the Wiener, and all of the really nasty perverted sex tapes that may or may not have been on those FBI purloined PCs. So we're still watching things unfold. And at least for now, be very skeptical and very watchful.